Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who knows that there are songs and there's banter. This is just banter. Here is the captain.
Yeah, it's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week, we are really happy to be featuring Huggins Hefeweizen by the good folks over at Hell and Blazes in Melbourne, Florida. Huggins is a delightful wheat beer, bold enough for the cold days of spring and refreshing enough for the warm days of spring. Huggins Hef was named Best Beer in Florida 2023. I like mine with a slice of orange. ABV 5.1%, garage grade 3.5 bottle caps out of 5. And here's some cheers to some of our garage buddies that are a slice of delightfulness themselves.
Yeah, a big we like your jib to Whitney Bach in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Next up, we have Arion in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. And last but certainly not least, we have Anna Banana from Highland, Illinois. Everyone we just mentioned, they went to our website and contributed to this week's beer fund. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, BWWRUN, beer run. When you get some time, because I know you're busy. Busy, busy bee. Go to truecrimegarage.com and make sure you sign up on the mailing list. And Colonel, that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. Thursday, November 21st, 1985, Malabar, Florida. It had been mostly a clear day and relatively comfortable by Florida standards. A 19-year-old woman was walking down the quiet and friendly streets of Malabar. Her trip to Florida seemed far less eventful than she had hoped for. This young woman was in town from California. She had planned to stay for a while and visit some friends who had recently moved from California to Florida. It was around 1 p.m. The temperature was a steady 80 degrees. She was getting tired of walking. That is when a car slowed down and pulled over to the side of the road, just feet from the young woman. The car was average looking, the windows were down, and she could hear the radio being turned down as the car's wheels slowed to a complete stop. The driver was average looking as well. He was a man in his mid-30s or so, at least that was her guess. He looked very Florida, she thought. He was thin, about medium height, with dyed blonde hair and a Florida tan. "Where are you going? Do you want a ride?" he yelled out, looking at her through the passenger side window that was in the fully down position. A young woman approached the car and leaned in. She told the man where she was headed. He told her he would be happy to accommodate her. She jumped in the back seat, and the car pulled from the curb and continued down the street. They had some quick chit-chat, "What's your name? Where are you from?" sort of stuff. He seemed nice enough, she thought. The man said that where the young woman was going was near his place of work. And good news for her, that was where he was going as well. He told her that he was on his lunch break and due to be back to work soon. He was going to head to his house real quick and pick something up. He had a notebook there that he needed to collect for work. He said after the brief stop, the two would be on their way. It didn't take long, and the car was turning into a gravel driveway. The house looked nice, bigger than normal, with a good-sized yard. The house was somewhat nestled back off of the road behind some full-grown trees. She could feel the temperature of the car's interior cool a bit when the car pulled into the driveway under the shade of several trees. The vehicle stopped. The man looked back at her and said, "Well, this is it. This is my house. We have a couple of minutes. Would you like to come in for a drink?" he asked. "No, thank you," she replied. He asked again. "Oh, come on," he said. "It would be quick." "No, thanks," she replied. The man got out of the car and he walked around to the back of the passenger side. He opened up the door to the back seat. This startled her a bit. Again, he was asking her to go inside the house with him, and again, she said no. That is when the man reached over her. He put a rope around her neck with both hands. Then he twisted the rope. She grabbed onto the rope herself, but it was no use. It was too late. She was too small, and he had control of her. The man tightened the rope again, and this time he leaned back and leveraged his weight against hers. He easily pulled her from the car. The rope around her neck in the hands of this man was now dictating her movements. She tried to fight back, but he dragged her from the car. He forced her down to the ground. Then he started pulling her toward the house, dragging her slowly, a couple of feet at a time. She could feel her body burning as she was dragged along the dirt and gravel. She could feel her neck burning from the rope digging into her skin. And now, she couldn't breathe. She was becoming weaker with every tug of the rope. The rope was so tight that she could not scream for help. The man dragged her from the car, across the yard, over the threshold, and through the doorway. She couldn't scream. She couldn't breathe. Her vision had gone black. She gasped, even convulsed, trying to get air. Her hearing was gone. Then, she blacked out. This is True Crime Garage. The woman whose real-life nightmare we just described was 19-year-old Laura Murphy. The young woman woke up unsure of how long she had been out. She was fully restrained. She was tied up and tied down to a countertop in the kitchen of her abductor. She was nude. The man had ripped the clothes right off of her. He was naked too. Then he raped her. She blacked out again. When she came to, she could tell by the lack of sunlight coming into the home that it was now much later in the day. The man was inserting needles into her arm. He was withdrawing blood from her. "What are you doing?" she screamed at him. He looked at her and said calmly, "I'm taking your blood out. I'm a vampire." She turned her head. She could see a beaker filling with her blood, and then she blacked out again. This time she woke up, she was handcuffed and naked. She was in a waterbed with the man. Now, it must have been morning time, she thought. Her wrists were handcuffed together and her ankles were cuffed as well. She was very weak from the whole attack. By this time, she did not know how long she had been inside the abductor's home or how many times he had raped her and how much blood of hers that he had, quote, taken out. After the assault, the man moved from the bed to a nearby bathroom. He pushed her to the floor inside the small bathroom and closed the door. She could hear him locking the door from the outside. She was hysterical, but she forced herself to be quiet. She wanted to try her best to stay awake and to see what she could hear. Maybe she could try to determine what was going on outside of that bathroom. She wanted to see if she could hear the man coming back. But things seemed to quiet down, and after a while, she thought that perhaps she had heard the man leave. She heard what sounded like the front door closing, a car starting, and then driving off. Now, if this were true, the man had not secured her good enough, and even though she was bloodied, beaten, and very weak, she thought that she had just enough left in her to try to make an escape. Because if that man came back, he was going to kill her once he was done with her, and there was no doubt about that in her mind. This was her chance, one last chance to save her own life. She managed to get out through a window. She wasn't able to get her wrists and ankles freed from the handcuffs. However, once outside, she was forced to crawl. So she was incredibly weak, and she didn't know how far she'd be able to make it or how much longer she had.
Our victim is trying to save herself, but she doesn't know if her body is going to be able to sustain her escape. And she has no clue really what time of day or night it is.
Exactly, because she's been blacking out. She's in and out during the course of this attack. Her abductor's in control of everything. She's not aware how long she's been held captive by this man who was draining her blood. So she doesn't know it, Captain, but it is actually just before noon on Friday, November 22nd, 1985. And she's crawling alongside of Hall Road in Malabar, Florida. This is when a passing motorist finds her. So this person driving gets out of his car. He runs over to the woman. She told him that several cars had already passed by without helping. He told her that he was not going to leave her there and that he was going to get her some help. So he pulls her up, puts her back onto her feet, helps get her into the car, and she's begging him, "Don't make me go back to that house." That house, he asks, which one? She motioned to a house not too far away, one that was nestled off of the road behind some large trees. The woman, in a very weak voice, told the man, "Do not forget that house. That is the house that I just escaped from." This is our Good Samaritan of the week here, Captain. He picked her up and he took her to his house. Lucky for him, there's other people there to assist once they arrive. His mother-in-law was there to try to help calm the woman and make her as comfortable as possible, while our Good Samaritan called for an ambulance and then called to the police. At the hospital, this young woman, Laura Murphy, was told that she was just hours away from death. She had lost a little more than 40% of her blood. Miss Murphy told police that she was visiting from California and a man had picked her up hitchhiking. He had stopped by his house under the pretense of picking up a notebook, then thrown a rope around her neck, dragged her inside. The police determined that the woman had been held captive for about 22 hours.
Wow.
She told the police everything that the man did to her, or at least everything that she could remember.
Right.
She went on to tell them that the man also used surgical equipment to drain her blood into a jar. Then he drank what he could. The house and the location, both described to police by the victim and the Good Samaritan, was determined to be 2180 Hall Road, Malabar, Florida. The house belonged to 39-year-old John Brennan Crutchley. Crutchley lived there with his wife and 4-year-old son. After hearing the victim's story, detectives got a search warrant and descended on Crutchley's home. We should point out here, Captain, that the Good Samaritan we are talking about is Thomas Frank Harper.
So as law enforcement is going to investigate this woman's claims, they're also going to speak with this Good Samaritan.
Yeah, Frank the Tank Harper, they need to talk to him, find out what he saw, what she told him, right? Because she's transported to the hospital. She's in a very weak state. She may have given him valuable information, and now she's unable to pass this along to police. So they're going to get some details from him, and they're going to talk to his family as well. And the strange thing here is he actually lives very nearby John Crutchley, but he tells the police that he did not know the man and had never spoke with him, even though the two were practically neighbors. Once at the Crutchley home, they do speak with John Crutchley. He told the detectives that this was all a misunderstanding. He said, yes, that he did pick up the young woman from California in his car. And yes, he did take her to his house. But Crutchley said the victim was, quote, a second generation Charles Manson follower, and she'd consented to kinky sex with him. None of that mattered. The police had their search warrant and they were coming in. Crutchley, they said, was fidgety and visibly nervous during their interaction with him once they were inside of his home. Police quickly learned that Crutchley's wife and 4-year-old son, who lived at the house as well, they were out of town for the weekend visiting her parents in Maryland. So this is right around, you notice the date, it's right around the Thanksgiving holiday. So his wife and son traveled back home to see her parents for the holiday.
Yeah, when the wife is away, the psychopath will play.
Crutchley tried and tried to plea his case to detectives. Remember, he's sticking with his story that the woman had consented to this kinky sex with him and that he had done nothing wrong. He told police that he had done this with other consenting women in the past, and he was into this sort of sex with bondage and pain, and that women were into this sort of thing too. He told them that the blood was just another part of the kink, and that oftentimes the bloodletting was performed on both the woman and himself as well. Crutchley almost seemed excited to talk to the detective about the bloodletting. But at some point, his fast talking slowed down. Then he was quiet, then he became hysterical, and he was crying in front of the officers. This is after police found items in the home confirming the young woman's story. She's still at the hospital, but they're finding evidence of everything that she said happened that this monster did to her. Detective Leatherow, who was on the scene, later said, quote, "I think it was starting to set in that he was going to be arrested. And I think he thought that's why Crutchley started crying in front of the officers." Police arrested John Crutchley, and they collected plenty of evidence from his home. This included ribbons, rope, and leather restraints. They also found a jar of hair clippings. Now, nothing strange about that. Chains, marijuana and drug paraphernalia, dozens of women's necklaces, surgical type equipment, tubing, needles, and the jar that was being used to drink the woman's blood.
Can you imagine being law enforcement and hearing this psycho try to minimize every action that he did against this victim?
Well, and as a, you know, cop and detective, you're walking around. As you're walking out and you're seeing other officers arrive on the scene, or you're talking to the officers just outside of the house after they've been inside themselves, you're going, yeah, been on the force 15 years, been on a lot of calls. This one might be the strangest one yet. In the end, Captain John Brennan Crutchley was arrested on 11 charges, including kidnapping, robbery, aggravated battery, possession of a controlled substance, and 2 counts of sexual battery. Following the arrest, he was held without bond in the Brevard County, Florida jail. The police were calling him Count Malabar, and the newspapers called him the vampire rapist.
So who is this psycho vampire?
This is one of those things, right? You make the arrest in this case, and to law enforcement, anybody on the scene, anybody that talked to the victim, anybody that talked to Crutchley as well, looks pretty darn guilty of some pretty heinous crimes. But don't hit the stop button yet here, my garage friends, because this story is truly just getting started. For those that tuned in last week, you already have some sense of where this story may be going.
Right.
Plus our Florida listeners who followed the news and following true crime in the 80s and 90s know that this is a huge story with tentacles stretching far and wide to not just unsolved murders, but also women disappearing in Florida. But also, we need to include several other states as well. Now, John Brennan Crutchley, at the time of his Florida vampire case arrest, was 39 years old, living with his wife, Karen, and son at 2180 Hall Road. He was an engineer in the Government Systems Division of Harris Corporation, which has locations in Orlando, Palm Beach, and Melbourne, Florida. Now, those areas are all fairly close together. You could drive to all three in about a matter of an hour and a half's time.
Right.
Crutchley moved to Florida in 1983. Keep in mind, this case is 1985, so he's not been in the state for terribly long. Now, I've not been able to pinpoint the exact date when he moved there. We do know it was in 1983. I did find some information that states that he moved there in June of 1983, but we don't have the exact date, which could come into play when we start talking about some other cases that we might try to tie him to. The thing that gives us that June date is we know that he started working at the Harris Corporation in June of 1983. So that would make some sense. It is noteworthy to know that the Harris Corporation was highly involved with NASA research and launch facilities, and a contractor of the Navy as well. So due to the nature of his work, Crutchley also had top secret security clearance at several facilities and access to classified materials. Remember, last week we spent some time discussing security clearances, especially at the Norfolk Navy base up in Virginia.
Last week we have spies. This week we have vampires.
Growing up, John was just one of four kids. Unfortunately, the eldest child, a daughter, passed away at the young age of 13. This was more than a year before John was born, and her death was due to health issues. It is believed that this is why John's parents chose to have more children, because there's a gap between the ages of these children. This was an affluent family in Clarksburg, West Virginia. John would later claim that his parents subjected him to severe abuse. His mother spoke with newspaper reporters and said that John made that up. We know that during the sentencing process, a review of mitigating factors are taken into consideration to arrive at what should be the proper punishment for the crimes that a person is on trial for. I can't say, Captain, if John was abused or not, but it would not be the first time that a convict fought for leniency by lying about his childhood.
It becomes chicken or the egg, or nature versus nurture.
I can say this: Florida detectives interviewed John's mom and are on record stating that his childhood was anything but normal. Details TBD, I guess.
Right.
Now, early in his adult life, John Crutchley moved around a lot. In some cases, this appears to be out of necessity for things like education, jobs, and maybe even his spouse's. I think one could also make a strong case that in some cases he may have been running from something. So can I point out something here that I know to be true in a couple of one-off homicide cases that we've covered, but also in some serial offender cases?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing if you are one of these types of bad guys, knowing that you are going to move states away, far away for legit reasons, is a scary thing to ponder when you are talking about these types of bad guys, right? That they know that they're going to move, or they're going to be called for military service, or they're going to go off to college somewhere. They're going to be taking a job in a state three states away 3 months from now. Well, to these types, that means now I can do some damage here and I can just burn rubber and get out of Dodge.
Yeah, it's almost like they look at it as a window of opportunity.
Crutchley was a smart kid. He had no trouble with classes that he took an interest in, but his grades were terrible in the subjects that he did that didn't hold his attention.
Right.
One thing that a lot of men find of interest is that someone like John, who we already know is not just a strange bird, but quite a sick and depraved individual, he seemed to possess the ability to find relationships fairly easy, you know, those with the fairer gender. Soon after high school, he got married. This was 1969. He's only 19 years old. This will be his first of two marriages. Then after the marriage, he earns a Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Defiance College in Ohio. This is in 1970. He then goes on to earn a Master of Engineering degree in Engineering Administration at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So we know that he was in West Virginia as a boy. We know he's in Ohio as a 19-year-old young man, and now we have him in Washington, D.C. just the following year.
And the question that law enforcement is going to have to start asking themselves is, when do we think that he started his criminal activities?
Yeah, because the very bizarre behavior that he's arrested for in 1985 down in Florida, he's 39 years old at this time. And we've talked about this plenty of times on the show, that the average age of an active serial killer is mid to late 20s. Now, after his time in D.C., then he and his first wife, they move out to Kokomo, and we are not talking about the Beach Boys Kokomo, of course. We are talking about Kokomo, Indiana. The
Aruba, Jamaica. Ooh, I want to take you to Bermuda, Bahamas. Come on, you pretty mamas. Is that right. How it goes?
We're talking about Kokomo, Indiana, the number one numero uno vacation destination in America. There, he was working for a company that accused him of stealing like $4,000 worth of some kind of equipment. So then he and his wife, they're already having marital problems.
You think?
And him losing this job likely was the straw that broke the camel's back. Poor camel. After Kokomo, he moved to Fairfax, Virginia, and remarried in the mid-70s. John then worked for several high-tech firms in the Washington, D.C. area, including TRW, ICA, and Logicon Process Systems. Now, at the time of his 1985 Malabar, Florida arrest, he was successful with a well-paying, respectable job. His neighbors said that John, his wife, and four-year-old child were as quiet as their neighborhood. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. And I love this. Shopping at quince.com/garage. You're going to love it too. You can shop for men, women, baby, and kids. And they even have suitcases and essentials for your home as well. Check them out. You're going to love the way that you look. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/garage for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/garage to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/garage. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security. Trusted by experts, SimpliSafe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News and World Report. And Newsweek awarded it Best Customer Service in Home Security. The system blankets your whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more, plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day, so you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. With no contract and a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try SimpliSafe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. Listening to True Crime Garage, you already know dozens of reasons why you should have a home security system to protect you, your property, and most importantly, your family. You can sleep great at night knowing that your windows and doors are secure and your family is safe. But what about when you're not home? Think about fires, floods, and the pets that we leave at home while we go to work each day. We need to protect them even when we are not home. SimpliSafe can do that for you. SimpliSafe has given many listeners real peace of mind. You should have it too. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/garage. That's simplisafe.com/garage. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
All right, we are back. Cheers to you, mates.
Tall cans in the air.
Cheers to the people in the back.
Right. The home and property where John and his wife lived, I think, is a little interesting here, Captain. This is a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom, nicer sized home. It's well landscaped. It's a little out of the way. So he's not, you know, he doesn't have any really close neighbors. It's a 2.7-acre lot, complete with 2 separate living quarters, a swimming pool, a slide, and a swing set. There is an open space that John called the pasture area. The lot includes double carports, and John owned a bunch of motorcycles and a red MG sports car. Plus, he also owned another vehicle that we're going to talk about here in a little bit that will be more important to our investigation. John Crutchley is arrested in the early morning hours of November 23rd, 1985. So, unfortunately, several hours would pass between the time that his victim escaped from his little vampire lair by knocking out the bathroom window, climbing up, and then falling face and shoulder first to the ground outside, to when the time that the police can get the actual search warrant and get to the house and get inside the house. So, of course, that's going to be problematic, but it happens all of the time when seeking a search warrant. So if, in fact, that is the case, John Crutchley's going to have a little bit of time from the time that he gets home from work, realizes that she's gone, to the time that they can get this search warrant. He's going to have some time to try to destroy some of the evidence.
And there's a part of him that wanted to go lay down in his coffin to re-energize his vampire spirits, but he knew that he had to clean.
A real vampire would have worked the third shift, but John's one of those fake vampires.
Yeah.
The other part of this that sucks, but is also understandable, is that he was held. So at first he's held without bond, and then that's changed to $50,000 bond. Remember, he's got a good paying job, so he just pays this, and he actually gets out for about 4 weeks.
You'd think they would say that he's a flight risk, right?
I would think so, but
I mean, this is the definition of caught red-handed.
He could turn into a bat and at any time just fly away.
Yeah, and you don't want that to happen.
Right, so he gets this, we have this weird scenario here where, and I think a lot of this has to do with the crimes, right? There's not a bone in my body that doesn't know that this guy would have killed this young woman, Laura Murphy. He just didn't get the opportunity to. He was going to slowly kill her over the course of that weekend that his family was gone. She, luckily for her, was able to escape. So I think because he's not charged with murder, he's charged with just about everything that you can be except for a homicide and murder, that he's allowed to make this bond, pay the bond, and he gets out. Like I said, he's out for approximately 4 weeks.
Do we have any clue what's happening with his family during this time period? Because if I came home and my husband was accused of kidnapping, raping, and sucking the blood out of this victim, I wouldn't be sticking around.
Well, I don't know exactly what's happening between, you know, inside those four walls.
She's just walking around with piles of garlic on her.
husband and wife, but what's weird here is I do know in the end she did divorce this man at some point. And well, I think
good for her.
Yeah, and I don't think we're far away in our timeline from that divorce, but she also kind of defends him publicly as well. So what I'm getting at is if I had to take a guess at it, I don't think that she clearly wasn't throwing him under the bus when she talked to the newspapers. But
I guess there's a piece of shit for every piece of shit.
Yeah, but what's going to be problematic here is, remember, police and detectives are always at a disadvantage in this little game, right? This little investigation game. They're, because of the nature of what they do, they're always one step behind, right? The crime is committed and then you start your investigation. So you start off behind the ball.
Well, not to point this out, but you can't start the investigation before the crime happens.
It's not Minority Report. But in this situation, what the police do not know, I bet you the seasoned detectives are guessing this, that we might have to look at this guy for other crimes. But the thing here is, you went and you investigated the crime that he was accused of by Laura Murphy. You arrested him. You place him in jail. Now there's going to be a delay until there's a trial. He makes bail and he gets out for 4 weeks. So while you later will determine that you need to investigate this guy for other crimes, he now has bought some time of 4 weeks so that during this time he can, what evidence there may have been, he has the opportunity to hide, conceal, burn, bury, and destroy any of that evidence.
Yeah, and I know we've called her a victim, but what we should be stating, and it's obvious, she's a freaking hero.
Yes.
Because if she doesn't get out, if she doesn't save her own life, then we might never be on to this guy. We might not be able to look into this vampire, quote-unquote, into other crimes. He would have just kept doing what he was doing. So not only did she save her life, but she might have saved a ton of other victims' lives.
So a whole lot of red flags here. We're going to talk about some of the things that they found in the searches, right? Because they end up ultimately conducting multiple searches on this guy leading up to his trial. So the home is searched. And we did talk about some of the items already recovered from his house. I left out dog collars. So listen to this report. Detectives quickly learned of Crutchley's kinky, violent behavior. In his house, they found dog collars, ropes, chains, and surgical equipment used to drink his victim's blood. So if you are a detective, Captain, and you enter the home of a sexual sadist blood drinker, and you find a bunch of dog collars and no dog, well, that's an uncomfortable situation.
You think?
Yeah.
Hey, nice dog collars. Your labradoodle?
And then listen to this. So you know that your guy is likely a serial abductor when you find the following.
Okay.
So this is part of the report. When police were conducting their search of Crutchley's home, they noticed Crutchley's Nissan Stanza automobile. All of the markings identifying the make and model of the car had been stripped off. And he had used black tape to cover the logo, the Nissan logo on the hubcaps, because he couldn't remove it. But any of the other Nissan marks or Stanza markings have been stripped off the vehicle. You're only doing that to try to go undetected.
Not only is this guy a psycho that's going to try to kidnap you, rape you, and kill you, but he's also cheap because he's not going to buy new hubcaps.
Right. I guess he could have just replaced them, but he taped over him. And then this son of a bitch gets out for 4 weeks, a couple of months before his trial, and he had to be getting rid of evidence at this point. So this is from a jailhouse buddy of John Crutchley's. This dude's name is Jackie Horton. Horton was awaiting trial on robbery and false imprisonment charges. When John Crutchley posted his bond December 2nd, so remember, he's arrested on the 23rd of November. He's able to pay to get out on December 2nd. He not only paid his, but he paid Horton's too, because they had become buddies talking in jail. So when Horton gets out of jail with John Crutchley, Horton moved into John Crutchley's Malabar home.
So they could suck each other's blood.
Well, Horton later told police that Crutchley wanted sex. And that on one occasion, Horton said he feared for his life when Crutchley began choking him during intercourse. He said, quote, he was holding onto my throat and I had to use both of my hands just to contain his hand.
So he's a bisexual vampire.
Well, Horton had other news for police, and this is even more disturbing. According to a sworn statement Horton gave detectives after Crutchley got out of jail, he began gathering items from the safe that was located in his home, the computer room, and other parts of the house. And Horton said that Crutchley filled about a third of one of those large trash bags. And when Crutchley was finished filling the bag, he left the house on foot to dispose of the bag. And he returned about 20 minutes or so later. And he says, quote, he just advised me that it was best that I didn't know what he was doing, end quote. He also told Horton that he should stay in the house and ignore what he was doing for a while. Sheriff's Detective Bob Lethereau recently said that the location and contents of the bag continue to haunt him and everyone else who has investigated the case. Quote, we've done everything, air searches, ground searches, water searches, dog searches, the detective said. Is it still out there? I just don't know. I would love to find it.
Yeah, because I wouldn't want to open that bag, but obviously it's important for their investigation. Kind of reminds me of the O.J. Simpson travel bag. I'd really love to know what was inside, what the contents of that that bag was.
Well, and remember, police are responding to an abduction and a rape case, right? They're not responding to a homicide or a serial killer case.
Do you actually think law enforcement is so dumb to not see where this crime was heading?
No, I don't think that for one bit.
Right.
But I'm pointing that out because what we do have is a gentleman that gets involved in this case is Robert Ressler, who we know is legendary mind hunter, FBI profiler, one of the first to start the profile.
MFBI.
Yeah, one of the first to start the profiling business. So he gives his two cents about this case, and he's saying conventionally trained police officers just aren't trained to see certain things. The things that, you know, he's saying that he worked on the Jeffrey Dahmer case and that police there missed dozens of items that would have been seen if they had been trained to. You know, right. So he's saying that, you know, if me and John Douglas and other individuals from the FBI were the ones to respond to this scene, that they would be looking for different things than what your regular cop would be looking for.
Yeah, because I felt like, again, Captain Obvious, normal detectives have to be vastly versed in what they look at and the different crimes they look at. Where the profilers are experts in certain areas of the criminal mind that most detectives will never encounter.
Well, and to the credit of law enforcement, especially the ones in this case, again, I think it really boils down to you are responding to a call. Right. You're already behind the ball there. You're responding to a call. When the FBI is called in and responding and going to a house, they're already pretty sure, like, you know, we're only being called in because this is a very serious offender. Right?
Right.
Like, and I know that it gets a little confusing to the listeners and even to us because we talk about a serial killer once a month here in the garage. Most police officers and detectives will work their entire career and never investigate a serial killer. They never will. It's a rare type of offender. And so I think that you become seasoned to that and used to that in that routine over the years that most of your killers that you will encounter in investigations that you will work during your career are people that simply kill one person. And so I think that when you walk into that scene, I think that Robert Ressler is correct. That they are not trained to search for certain things and look or to see things the way that Robert Ressler would see them if he were at the crime scene.
Absolutely.
He very likely would have conducted his search in a different manner. But I don't think that we should look at that as a critique or a criticism of law enforcement, because again, they are responding to the call that they got.
But right? Aren't they the ones that have to then call in the FBI?
So correct. Like, well, in which they did in this case.
Yes. And every time this happens, it's like, I just want to scream from the rooftops. If you're not an expert, call in the expert. You don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. You don't have to be the smartest guy in the garage. You just have to be the guy that set up the microphone to record that guy. And you can get pretty far in life by doing that. I'm proof of it.
Well, and the detective here, Lethereau, I really like this guy. This guy has a passion for his work that he does in a very...
We like the cut of his jib.
He's very passionate about this case in particular, and I've heard him speak about this case, and I will say this, like, he at times sounds like a defeated, confused man, because I think he worked this as best as he could, and I don't think that the case or the investigation went to where he thought that it could.
But again, no judge should have let this man out.
Well, you're right. I agree with that.
And I understand that we have a system that is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. But when there's crimes that are this heinous and we have a definitive victim here, there's no question that she was a victim by somebody, right? So therefore we go, hey, until we can figure this out, it's in the best interest of the public and the best interest of this investigation to leave this pile of shit vampire wannabe in jail.
Right. And the thing is, he's not necessarily caught red-handed, but when you have a woman who, as you pointed out so rightfully so, is very obviously the victim of something, you pick her up, she gives you the statement, and then you go inside this guy's home and you find needles, tubing, surgical equipment, and a beaker that was used to drain her blood. Guess what? You go into thousands and thousands and thousands of homes, you're not going to find any of that stuff. So that stuff, to me, very much confirms her story as being true, as being real, as being factual. You have the guy. So he's not caught red-handed, but he looks incredibly guilty. So I'm with you. And of course, there's a lot of people in this story and in a lot of true crime stories that look back and wish that they would have done things differently.
Right. But we also have a credible eyewitness, and he can state for the record, when I found her in the state that she was in, she pointed to this house and who lives there. The guy that we arrested, and this guy doesn't get to go free. He doesn't get a chance because, again, go back to that bag. What's in the bag? If they could find the bag, what other crimes does that possibly connect him to? Is that the nail in the coffin? No pun intended. In this case and possibly other cases.
So to the police's credit here, they did conduct a search of his office. So John Crutchley's work office at Harris Corp was searched, and that search was conducted on December 20th, 1985. Crutchley's office at Harris Corp was searched after they fired Crutchley on December 20th and then denying him access to the plant before he could retrieve his personal belongings. So I don't have enough detailed information here to say this 100%, but what I believe this to mean here, Captain, is that while he was arrested on the 23rd, he doesn't get out until December 2nd. I don't think he had access to his office at any time from December 2nd to December 20th when it was searched.
Right.
And I think that it was, I don't know if they were just doing things by the book and waited until he was officially fired from that job before the search was conducted, but we do know a search was conducted. So investigators in his desk, they found a wallet insert. You remember those old inserts that you would put in a wallet? This insert contained an identification card belonging to a one Patty Valinsky. And it also had pictures of a little boy. Later, police would learn that the pictures of the boy were of Patty Valinsky's son.
Right.
So they find this at Crutchley's office. Now, they also found identification belonging to Crutchley's first wife and to a former roommate. And I don't want to go too far down this path here.
Yeah, the rabbit hole.
Over the years, I've heard a lot of different versions of ID cards and driver's license that they found in this case. Some of them even state, like, well, we know he killed 12 or 24 women because they found 24 different driver's license when they arrested this guy and searched his home and his office. Or they found 12 different driver's license and identifications cards in his home.
Right.
No, the real story, you can go read all those if you want there. They're certainly out there. And you can go listen to them, too. They're certainly available for your earballs and your eyeballs. But the true story from the mouth of the detective who led this case and did this investigation states, we found four identification cards or driver's license. And we've been told who those belong to. So one of them was this Patty Valinsky. The other was his first wife. And the other was a former roommate. Now, the first wife and former roommate, they're still alive.
They're obviously not murder victims.
So where does the fourth identification card come in? So earlier, when detectives searched Crutchley's house, and this is to their credit, where Ressler believes they may have missed some things, this I believe shows that they were conducting a very thorough investigation. And this comes from the detective's mouth. So he says, when we were searching Crutchley's house, we discovered a driver's license belonging to the kidnap and rape victim.
Right.
And the detective says, quote, John felt he'd beat us. He'd gotten rid of all the victim's stuff, but he had to keep her California driver's license. He couldn't let it go. He put it in the little pocket of a soaking wet bathing suit. That's how crafty he was. He figured no one would pick up the wet bathing suit. Well, they did. And when they were there, they found that driver's license in that bathing suit, confirming 100%, near 100%, that woman was in his home as she said she was.
But that's
interesting, the psychology of what the detective's talking about, the psychology of this man, that he was there at the home and had opportunity to get rid of evidence.
It's fascinating.
But he couldn't part with this driver's license. He needed to keep it for some reason, and he tried to hide it from the detectives, thinking they would never find it, and then he could keep it later as some kind of trophy.
It's fascinating because it's the obsession, the addiction is so strong that he couldn't part with this item, and almost like that he would lose a connection to the crime, that maybe he would lose connection to the fantasy of the crime if he lost this item. So, I mean, it's fascinating.
Well, and he had a good attorney too. So when you have a good attorney and you have the means to get out of jail and you tell your attorney who has to work as a fiduciary for you, and you tell him, look, I want to be out. I want to be home waiting for this trial rather than sitting in this jail cell. So your attorney is going to go before the judge and point out all the reasons why you should be allowed to pay the bond, post the bond, and get out of jail. And of course the attorney does this. So it says, you know, he's never been arrested. You know, my client has never been charged with anything. This is all a misunderstanding. He's able to pay post the bond. He is a contributor to society. He is the breadwinner for his family, his wife and son depend on him and depend on his income. So you make all these reasons why he should be allowed to leave. And so, as said, he posted that bond. So to kind of complete our timeline a little better here, Crutchley is out of jail and free to roam the state of Florida from December 2nd when he posted bond. This lasts until January 9th. This is really interesting. This is where the judge and the prosecutor I think, got a little creative, because I'm with you, Captain. He shouldn't have been let out. You wish that he wouldn't have been let out. I think that the judge and the prosecutor wish that he wouldn't have been let out as well. And I think that this is evidence of this. So,
well, because it's a dangerous time period. It's just like, if we rewind for a second, what you said, when a psycho knows that they're going to move, it's a window of opportunity to commit crimes. And then once I move, I'm less likely to become a suspect. But you have the same scenario when somebody's released from prison. And if in his mind, if he starts thinking, hey, they really got me on this crime, and there's no chance that I'm going to get away with this, I might as well commit more crimes before I go away for the first crime.
So he's out until January 9th.
Yeah.
And I love this move right here. So the judge then decides,
stanky leg.
Well, he decides, oh, your very important, respectable job that you have. Remember, I let you out. I let you post bond because you are a contributor to society.
You're breadwinner.
You are breadwinner, and you have to take care of your wife and kid and the house and everything. Oh, Harris Corporation fired you because you're a vampire. I wonder if that's what they put on the paperwork.
Yeah.
Reason, vampire. like, that's an easy HR move, right? Vampire.
Yeah. Why were you fired from your last position? Well, they said I was a vampire.
And they don't like vampires. So the judge then goes, well, you are no longer contributing to society. You don't have a job. You are no longer providing for your wife and child because you lost your job. So your ass is going back to jail and waiting for this trial. So they raised the bond from $50,000 to $500,000.
Wow.
And that is why he was returned to jail to wait for his trial. Now, we're going to fast forward from January to June. Thankfully, he's behind bars all that time. So June of 1986, John Crutchley pleads guilty to 3 of the 11 charges. So they had a bit of a plea agreement here. He pleads guilty to 3 of the 11 charges. The rest were dropped. This is Circuit Judge John Altoon. Listen to this. This guy got creative here as well.
Yeah.
So John Altoon sentenced Crutchley to 25 years in state prison, which was the maximum that he would be allowed. Like, and you know, judges have a lot of power, but the state determines what the maximum sentence can be in a lot of these cases. And so in a way here, Judge Altoon, he's a bit handcuffed himself. He really wanted to put this dude in prison for life because he thought he was so dangerous, such a danger to society, that he should never be able to leave the prison walls. But he's bound by the state to only 25 years, which was the maximum. So he gets 25 years in state prison with psychiatric treatment. And after that, he's going to get 50 years of probation. Now, that's what the judge could do. That he gave him 50 years of probation, which is really interesting to me because, one, that makes it a lot easier for him to go back to prison. But two, if the probation is properly conducted, then he should be checking in, meaning you can keep tabs on this guy a little bit, right? At least you'll have some checks and balances here with this very dangerous man. And you're hoping that he has to spend the full 25 years in prison, and maybe he would age out of this sexual deviancy or even this violent nature that he has.
Well, what's great is, hey, let's put him on probation. If he sneezes and accidentally farts, he's going back to jail. But I think maybe the play here, and let me know if you agree, is we think that we can get him on other charges, and maybe he's possibly connected to other crimes. So if we get him behind bars and we know that he's going to be there for 25 years, now the public is safe. And now we have a chance to build cases against him that then will put him away in prison for life.
And to give some credit where credit is due, Robert Ressler was called to testify at the trial.
Yeah.
And, or at the sentencing, I should say. And Ressler testified and told the judge, Look, I've been doing this a long time. I've seen a lot of these guys. This guy is one of those guys. This guy is a serial killer. I believe he's killed before. I believe he will kill again. If it were up to me, Judge, I would lock him up for his entire life and throw away the key. But as we all know, you can't punish someone for something you think that they did or think they will do. You have to punish them on something that you can prove that they did. So they were a little bit limited as well. Everybody wanted this guy to go away forever. Well, I shouldn't say everybody. We'll see that in just a minute. But almost everybody wanted this guy to go away forever, but their hands were tied a little bit. So they gave him the best sentence, I believe, that they possibly could. Now, his family, some of his family expressed shock and outrage at what they called the harshness of the decision. His wife, Karen, will tell the newspapers, quote, "I can't see why it," meaning the punishment, "exceeded the guidelines," end quote. Crutchley's wife, Karen, said, quote, "it was a gentle rape." Hard to believe that a woman would say that, to which I respond, listen, dummy, there is no such thing as a gentle rape.
No, and I think if you are convicted of rape, you should spend the rest of your life in prison, because that victim has to deal with your actions and has to deal with that assault for the rest of their life. They're affected for the rest of their life. So you should be affected for the rest of your life and stay in prison. Hey, vampire boy, come take your dog collar off and stay a while. Get cozy, because you're going to be doing more in prison than just sucking blood. I want to thank everybody so much for joining us here in the garage. Stick around for part two. And until then,
be good, be kind, and don't litter.